Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Red Beard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin land, also called Ottawa, Canada. This is episode 57 of Beyond Barbarossa, and today we're going to look at the Second Battle of Smolensk, 1943. Yes, I'm back from my break. I actually went to Nova Scotia for a vacation, just a tour around to a place I've never been to before, and it was great. I really enjoyed my time there. However, I'm sad to say that while I was there, one day I turned on one of my favorite podcasts and heard about the passing of David Knowles, the creator of the excellent podcast Ukraine the Latest. It came as a shock and a surprise. I've listened to that podcast every weekday for the past 2.5 years. I think it's the best English language podcast that I found, anyway, for keeping up to date on what's happening in Russia's unjustified evil war of aggression on its neighbor. I want to send my condolences again. I've done it privately, but I would like to say again publicly, condolences, sympathies to David Knowles' family, his friends, and his colleagues. And I'm going to also give a shout out to the rest of the Ukraine the Latest team, Francis Sternley, Dominic Nichols, Roland Oliphant, Joe Barnes, and the rest. You guys are doing a great job in continuing David's work. If you listeners are not familiar with Ukraine the Latest, I'll put a link in the show notes. If you want to know what's going on in Ukraine and Russia today, that is the best place to go. Now, the last two episodes described the Battle of the Dnipro and Operation Suvorov, the Red Army's push westward against German Army Group Center. Following the carnage of the Battle of Kursk, a tactical victory for the Germans and a costly and iconic strategic victory for the USSR, the Soviet Red Army retook the city of Kharkiv, then called Kharkov, in Ukraine, in the fourth and final Battle of Kharkov. Again, that's the final Battle of Kharkov during the Second World War. There have been other battles of Kharkov before and since. Now, I know it's been a while since we talked about these operations, so if you want to go back, if you need to refresh your memory, go back to episodes 55 and 56 after this episode. Operation Suvorov comprised six distinct offensive operations, driving toward the Russian cities of Yemensk, Demidov, Dorogobuzh, and Roslavl. Their ultimate goal, Smolensk, 400 kilometers or 250 miles west of Moscow. Two Soviet army fronts, which were groups of armies, were assigned to this task, the Western Front and the Kalinin Front. Opposing them was German Army Group Center. This was the professional, experienced Wehrmacht, the best army there ever was. Yes, just ask them. the Red Army launched Operation Suvorov on 7th August, grinding forward 25 kilometers or 15 miles in 4 days. As usual, they took heavy casualties and brought up more complete armies from other sectors to renew the attack. If you can call going from Nazi to communist control liberation, the Red Army liberated cities and towns like Vilnia, Demyansk, and Bryansk by mid-September. At this point, German tyrant Adolf Hitler allowed the Wehrmacht to pull back to defensive lines. His generals told Hitler this was going to be a temporary measure so they could shore up their defenses, build up their strength again, and then be in a better position for offensive operations against the Soviets. But even so, Hitler did not like the idea. It was Field Marshal Erich von Manstein, commander of Army Group South, and probably Germany's most capable general at this time. It took him to tell Hitler plainly that the Wehrmacht had no choice. It was either pull back or be annihilated. So they drew back to a defensive position called the Ostwall or East Wall, a more or less continuous line of fortifications from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Black Sea in the south. The northern portion was called the Panther Line, cool name, and the southern part the Wotan Line, named after the ancient Teutonic god. Meanwhile, to the south, the Red Army had launched another immense offensive to recapture half of Ukraine from the Dnipro River eastward. I've put a map on the webpage for this episode, as usual. And again, if you want to recap that, go back to the last episode of Season 2, number 56. So here we are, mid-September 1943. The Red Army is poised just east of Smolensk. Well, not just east, quite a distance. At any rate, they're ready for the next phase of the operation, retaking the city of Smolensk itself. But wait, before we get to that, we need some all-important context. To help us orient ourselves with the parts of the Second World War that are more familiar to us in the West, it's time for our regular feature. What else is happening in the war? 3rd September 1943, British troops land on the Italian mainland at Reggio Calabria. In July, the Italian government had arrested and deposed dictator Benito Mussolini following the Allied invasion of Sicily. So in September, they signed a secret armistice with the Western Allies. However, this would not be the second front that Stalin had been demanding. On 4th September, the USSR declared war on Bulgaria. On 8th September, the Allies formally announced the surrender of Italy to the Western Allies, and the Germans began moving large numbers of reinforcements into Italy to hold it against the Allies. This would have repercussions on the Eastern Front. Those troops had to come from somewhere. Then on 9th September, the Allies landed at Salerno and captured Taranto on the eastern heel of the Italian boot. The next day, the Germans occupied Rome and the Italian fleet surrendered to the Allies. On 12 September, German SS troops rescued Mussolini from a mountainous prison and set him up as the head of the so-called Italian Socialist Republic, basically Hitler's puppet. Now it's going to shift a little farther east to the Aegean Sea. Again, 12 September, the Germans began exterminating the civilian residents of villages on Crete in what became known as the Vianos Massacres. From 14th to 16th September, they murdered over 500 men and boys for supposedly supporting the British troops. On the 16th of September, the British forces began the Dodecanese campaign, landing on islands in the Aegean. That same day, British and American troops linked up in Italy near Salerno. On the 19th of September, the Germans began evacuating the Italian island of Sardinia. And on the 21st, we're going to move way to the east, to the Pacific. The Battle of the Solomon Islands in the Western Pacific is effectively over. Meanwhile, go back to the Mediterranean. The Germans, who have taken over the island of Cephalonia off the Greek west coast, eliminated 4,000 to 7,000 Italian soldiers, the former occupiers. On 22nd September, British midget submarines crippled the Tirpitz, the sister battleship to the Bismarck, at anchor in the Norwegian Arctic Ocean fjord of Kaffjord. On 28 September, as the Allies were advancing north along the Italian coast, the people of Naples rose up against their German occupiers in the so-called 4 Days of Naples. This spontaneous resistance prevented the Germans from deporting all Neapolitans and destroying the city. That was the situation on the Western Front. So now, let's shift our focus about 1,000 miles to the east, on the Eastern Front of the Second World War. Something I've been meaning to do in this podcast for a while is to incorporate reporting from the Eastern Front at the time, journalistic reporting. One of the most prominent Western reporters in Russia at that time was CBS reporter Bill Downs, who filed a report on 11 September 1943 titled "Fireworks and Salutes in Moscow as the Fighting Continues. Moscow Salutes as Italy Falls." Quote, "It was a quiet night in Moscow tonight. The Russian communique for a change did not proclaim a sensational victory, but this does not mean there were none. For example, in the drive west from Stalino, the Russian troops advanced from 6 to 7 miles. They took 70 inhabited points. In the central Ukraine, Russian troops moved from 3 to 6 miles toward Kiev. They took 20 inhabited points. Another 60 populated points were taken in the Bryansk salient, and a lot of them you can't even find on a map. What I'm trying to say is that, despite the apparent lack of what we call big news, the Red Army's advance is continuing. A lot of these unknown inhabited points might be, for individual groups of Russian soldiers, battles as bitter and bloody as the fighting that separate units did for Stalingrad. You don't need a special communique to die. You also don't need a special communique to capture an inhabited point." The fall of Italy is the most discussed news in Russia tonight. On the subway and in the streetcars and buses, people discuss the events in southern Europe. Meanwhile, people here in Moscow come home from work each night and wonder whether they will see any fireworks. In some neighborhoods, they have watched certain stations where these fireworks are set off, and they can see supply trucks coming in late in the evening. Thus, the word spreads that some new fireworks have arrived in such and such a district, and that a new prakaz is due from the Kremlin. End quote. After the Germans ended Operation Citadel, their attack on the Kursk salient, the Soviets began their own offensive operations, as described previously. Operation Suvorov began on 7th August, pushing the German Army Group Center west, while other fronts attacked in the southern sector, that is, Ukraine. After the offensives that started in August, Stavka's attention focused on retaking Smolensk. Operation Suvorov paused on 7th September, so like a month into the attack. For the next week, they reinforced and rebuilt their forces in this area. Then, on 14 September, the left flank, the Kalinin Front, and the Western Front restarted their offensive toward Smolensk. Now, Smolensk is a city with a historical significance far above its size. Smolensk was contested between the Tsardom of Muscovy and the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in the Middle Ages, and it was the site of a major battle between Russia and Napoleon in 1812. In 1941, the Germans invaded Russia. Yes, I know you know this already. And the Germans were checked for a time at Smolensk by Marshal Semyon Timoshenko. This is where a fateful decision occurred at the end of July 1941. Hitler told Army Group Center to pause there on their drive toward Moscow and diverted the panzer groups of Army Group Center north toward Leningrad and south to take Kiev. Or actually, didn't really pause, but the panzers divided north and south, and the drive toward Moscow was supposed to be carried out by infantry and some mechanized units. This division of forces was, according to some historians, the nail in the coffin of Germany's hopes to capture Moscow. But the Germans did manage to take Smolensk in the fall of 1941, despite Timoshenko's best efforts. And they continued from there to within artillery distance of Moscow by November 1941. But ever since then, and you can go back to the previous episodes in season 1 and 2, they had retreated from the Soviet capital. And that sets the stage for the Second Battle of Smolensk in 1943. So let's pause here and take a look at the participants on both sides. For this information, I'm drawing on Robert Forchik's book, Smolensk 1943, The Red Army's Relentless Advance. The Red Army brought two fronts or army groups to this operation, the Kalinin Front at the northern or right-hand side, and the Western Front, starting more or less directly east of Smolensk itself. The Kalinin Front was commanded by General Andrei Ivanovich Yeremenko, who had commanded the Stalingrad Front, planned the defense of Stalingrad along with Nikita Khrushchev, and later commanded the Stalingrad Front in surrounding and destroying the German 6th Army. For Suvorov, the Kalinin Front consisted of four armies and the 3rd Air Army. The Western Front was commanded by General Vasily Danilovich Sokolovsky, then 46 years old and a protege of Georgi Zhukov. For the start of Operation Suvorov, the Western Front consisted of six armies, plus the 2nd Guards Tank Corps. Guards was an honorific given a unit in recognition of some achievement or display of courage. The 2nd Guards Tank Corps, the 5th Mechanized Corps, the 6th Guards Cavalry Corps, and the 68th Air Army. Now, unlike earlier operations in which the Soviets had relied on masses of infantry and meat attacks, the kind we can see the Russian army employing in Ukraine in 2024, by 1943, the Red Army was trying to adopt combined arms operations. Trying. Now, combined arms means using infantry, artillery, armor, air, and other specialized forces in concert. They defend each other, each one makes up for the vulnerabilities of another. Instead of just pushing people forward, you're using your mind. In Operation Suvorov and its endgame, the Battle of Smolensk, the Red Army intended to use mixed tank and cavalry units to take advantage of the wooded terrain around the city. In total, in August 1943, these two fronts comprised 1,252,600 soldiers, 20,640 guns, 1,430 tanks, and 1,100 aircraft. But that was in August. By mid-September, the final phase of this operation to Smolensk, they had suffered significant casualties, although the total number is debatable at this point. The Soviets weren't good at being honest. There's another important contributor, though, to the action in the Smolensk area, both before and after the operations at the Smolensk, at the city of Smolensk itself. The catastrophic Soviet retreat in 1941 at the launch of Operation Barbarossa had left a lot of Red Army units and fighters behind the German lines. Many of these became partisans, in effect, guerrilla fighters. The Germans calculated in 1943 that there were some 20 brigade-sized partisan units in the area around Smolensk, totaling up to 21,000 armed soldiers. Now, they were armed mostly with rifles, sidearms, submachine guns, light weaponry, but some units did have mortars and even light artillery and anti-tank guns. These units were effective. They had an impact on the German operations. They destroyed railways and other communication lines, destroyed ammunition stores, and more. For example, due to sabotage on railroads, one German officer in 1943 reported taking 5 days to travel about 200 kilometers or 120 miles. The German response to this operation was to execute all non-German workers on the lines, leaving only German staff. But of course, there weren't enough to really do the work needed to run a railroad. As a result, communications and travel got even slower. So that's the Soviet side in the Smolensk area in September 1943. The Germans' biggest force in this area at the time was the 4th Army under Colonel General or General Oberst Gotthard Heinrici, who had led the army since January 1942. So been there a year and a half already. He had earned a reputation as the Wehrmacht's best defensive commander. By late summer 1943, the Fourth Army consisted of about 250,000 troops in 18 divisions. But by the time of the Smolensk operation, these units were all under strength. Some units had been scraped together from the remnants of, or survivors of other units, and these were called division battalions. According to Robert Forchik, quote, "The only infantry division near full strength was the 113th Infantry Division in 29th Panzer Corps. But it was a newly raised unit intended to replace the original division lost 6 months before at Stalingrad. About 80% of 113 Infantry Division's troops consisted of personnel transferred from the Luftwaffe, or new recruits. After 4 months' training in France, the division was transferred to the Russian front just 2 weeks before Suvorov commenced." End quote. Forchik explains that most of the 4th Army was about 45% of their strength on paper. In other words, they had lost more than half their men by the time the Red Army began Operation Suvorov. Now, this 45% strength, it was in terms of people, but also equipment. Most soldiers in the 4th Army at this point were using older, somewhat obsolete rifles, as well as a lot of captured weapons. They had obsolete anti-tank guns and a motley assortment of captured transport vehicles, and they also faced a shortage of artillery ammunition. When it comes to artillery and armor, their force was limited. They had about 60 self-propelled assault guns and fewer than 500 tanks, compared to over 1,000 that the Soviets were bringing against them. Most of the German artillery and armor units were older, obsolete, battle-worn Panzer III and IV medium tanks. Just before the final Red Army move on Smolensk, Heinrici received a shipment of a few Tiger tanks, but they weren't enough. Again, to quote Forchik, "By this point in the war in the East, the severely depleted Panzer Divisionen were increasingly reduced to ineffectual detachments rather than fully-fledged combined arms teams, and were no longer able to dominate the battlefield the way they had in 1941 and 1942. End quote. The numbers of airplanes available to the Germans were also limited. Luftflotte 6 was the fleet in this sector, still an effective unit, even though it was reduced to about 350 combat aircraft. These included the Focke-Wulf 190A fighter, superior to most of the Soviet fighters in the area at this time, as well as the legendary Messerschmitt Bf 109G. Jagdgruppe 51 was one of the most experienced and best fighter units in the entire Luftwaffe. It included several ace pilots, like Oberleutnant Heinrich Hoffemeyer, who had 96 victories by August 1943, Oberleutnant Karl-Heinz Weber, with 85 victories at this point, Major Erich Ley, with 56 victories, and Leutnant Gunther Schock, with 50 victories. That's a lot of enemy planes shot down. In addition, there was a Spanish air unit in operation with the Luftwaffe in around Smolensk at this point. This was the infamous Blue Squadron, or Escuadrilla Azul, led by Spanish ace Major Mariano Cuadra Medina. Now, that's the strength on paper in August 1943, but as I explained, by mid-September, facing the last stage of the Soviet operation, the Germans had just three corps, so not armies, corps around Smolensk, compared to the nine armies that the Soviets were bringing against them. In total, 21,500 men, not 125,000. As well, by this time, most of Luftflotte 6, with those great aces, had been sent farther south to the fighting around Bryansk. The remaining bombers in the Smolensk sector were pulled back to bases farther west to protect them from Soviet attack. Now that we know the sizes of the opposing forces in this area, let's take a short break before we get into the action. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome back to episode 57 of Beyond Barbarossa, the Second Battle of Smolensk in 1943. On 14 September 1943, the Red Army began its assault towards Smolensk. And as usual, that began with a heavy artillery bombardment. On the right or northern side, from the Soviet point of view, the Kalinin Front penetrated as much as 13 kilometers or 8 miles deep across a salient 30 kilometers or 20 miles wide. The next day, to the south, the Western Front penetrated up to 10 kilometers or 6 miles on their first day. They liberated or captured the rail hub of Yartsevo, and at the left or southernmost end of the operation, established bridgeheads on the Desna River. Kurt von Tippelskirch, chief of staff of the 4th Army in this area at this point, wrote in his journal, quote, "The forces of the Soviet Western Front struck the left wing of Army Group Center from the Dorogobuzh-Yelnya line with the aim of achieving a breakthrough in the direction of Smolensk. It became clear that the salient, projecting far to the east, in which the 9th Army was positioned, could no longer be held," end quote. According to Robert Forchik, quote, "The German loss of both Dukoschina and Yartsevo effectively opened the door to a rapid advance upon Smolensk. Upon hearing of the liberation of both towns, Stalin ordered 12 artillery salvos fired in Moscow to commemorate the event and awarded honorific titles to the units involved," end quote. Meanwhile, Yeremenko moved 4 armies of his Western Front further south against the German 9th Army Corps west of Yelnya. Yelnya was the site of Guderian's first loss in 1941 to Georgi Zhukov. So, in 1943, German General Heinrici had earlier sent the 39th Panzer Corps from that Yelnya sector to help at Yartsevo, as we just heard, a futile effort. To replace them, as he realized that the Western Front was advancing toward Yelnya, he sent reinforcements. 1 battalion plus 1 single company. They arrived too late. Between the 13th and the 17th of September, the 39th Army tore into the 27th Army Corps and broke through the line. After taking Yartsevo, Yeremenko sent the 31st Army down to the Minsk-Moscow highway, straight towards Smolensk. The 10th Guards and the 68th Armies moved in from the southwest. The Germans had planned to use the upper Dnieper River as a defensive line because, famously, and you've heard this before, the western banks of the Dnieper typically are higher than the flatter eastern side, which gives the defenders a great advantage because it's on the higher ground. However, Red Army engineers quickly constructed pontoon bridges, and the Red Army got across. The Soviet soldiers doubtlessly were tired by this point, but they could sense an impending major victory. By 19th September, so 5 days into the operation, the Red Army had blasted a gap in the German lines 40 kilometers wide and 250 kilometers or 150 miles deep. They had to pause for a few days to rest, bring up more food, fuel, ammunition, and other supplies. But even though they were tired, probably exhausted, the Germans were in worse shape. In the last week alone, 1 week, they had lost 577 machine guns, 133 mortars, 81 anti-tank guns, and 39 artillery pieces. Rather than defending Smolensk, they intended on retreating to the Panther defensive line well west of the city. On 17 September, General Henrici ordered his forces to prepare to abandon Smolensk, which meant they would destroy it behind them. On 21st September, Yaremenko's Kalinin Front attacked the German right flank southeast of Smolensk itself. Then the next day, the Kalinin Western and Bryansk fronts altogether launched an all-out attack along the entire Smolensk sector. Some German units managed to conduct some counterattacks, especially if they had Tiger tanks. But even so, the Red Army broke through the defenses, and at the evening of 23rd September, Heinrici ordered the evacuation of Smolensk and its destruction. The 4th Army withdrew, leaving behind remnants of three divisions as their rear guard and the guys who were going to push down the plungers on all those explosives. Overnight of the 23rd to 24th September, these rear guard units start to lay the charges on railway stations, bridges, power plants, anything else that the Red Army might be able to use. Scorched earth. The following night, the 31st and 68th Red Armies began their final assault on Smolensk. Even as they advanced into the city, the Soviet troops heard explosions as the Germans blew up the power plant, the railway stations, and other infrastructure. General Sokolovsky knew that they had one last chance to capture the three remaining bridges over the Dnipro River, but they were too late. The Germans destroyed the bridges behind them at 4:46 a.m. on the 25th of September. But the Soviets took the city. There was little street fighting in this battle. The Germans were intent not on, you know, killing these Russians so much as getting the hell out of there, which meant that by 6 a.m., the 331st Rifle Division of the Red Army crossed the Dnipro River, and one Captain Prokofy Keplok raised the red banner over the Smolensk Hotel. The city was theirs. After Smolensk, the Germans fell back to the Panther Line, reaching it by 29 September. Some units of the Red Army pursued them down the Minsk Highway, but they were clearly exhausted. The whole Operation Suvorov, from August to the end of September, had cost the Soviets over 100,000 killed, and in total, nearly 350,000 casualties. That's wounded, sick, missing, captured, and so on. To quote from Anthony Tucker Jones' book, Thunder in the East. The whole Smolensk strategic operation between early August and early October advanced up to 150 miles on a 250 mile wide front. But at this rate, it would take 3 or 4 years to reach the western frontier. It was also an operation that was very expensive in human terms, costing the lives of 108,000 Soviet troops. End quote. The German 4th Army was also exhausted and suffering. At this point, at the end of the operation, had just over 10,000 combat troops left. According to Soviet sources, they had suffered 250,000 casualties. The Germans claimed their losses were 70,000. I'll leave it up to you to decide where between those numbers is more likely to be accurate. Despite their exhaustion, the Red Army were not allowed much rest. Stavka, the Soviet High Command, ordered the Western Front to capture Orsha, which is further west, and the Kalinin Front, Vitebsk, by 10th October. These orders were unrealistic, to say the least. The Red Army's advances on this front slowed down, and Yeremenko decided to end Operation Suvorov on 3rd October after failing to break through the German lines east of Orsha. Stavka was not as willing to stop, and they ordered the Western Front to break through the Panther Line. But it was no use, and the fighting sputtered to an end in November. One thing that doesn't get enough mention is the civilian suffering. As the Red Army advanced, they saw the effects of more than 2 years of German occupation. Anthony Beevor cites Australian war correspondent Godfrey Blunsden, who was there with the Red Army. Quote, "Some peasant families of old men, women, and children had returned and were camping in wigwams. In several places, they had hung out their washing on lines between trees, as if it were normal to have a washing day in this desecrated no man's land. There is some lesson in human persistence in the way these people come back to their old homes, but one could not help wondering how they would survive the coming winter." He was shaken to discover that, quote, "a little wizened old woman," end quote, whom he met was in fact a girl 13, end quote. How significant was the recapture of Smolensk? According to Robert Forchik, quote, "the Western and Kalinin fronts had achieved a great victory in Operation Suvorov by liberating Smolensk and pushing 4th Army back over 200 kilometers. However, the offensive had sputtered along for 57 days in a frustrating start-stop fashion due to persistent shortages of fuel and ammunition. Nor could there be any victory parade for the cameras in Smolensk, since the city was a smoldering pile of rubble. Altogether, the Western and Kalinin fronts committed 1.2 million troops to Operation Suvorov and suffered a total of 451,466 casualties in the offensive, including 107,645 dead or missing. Sokolovsky lost 40% of his original troop strength during the offensive, debilitating even by Red Army standards. Soviet material losses were also heavy during Operation Suvorov, including 863 tanks and over 300 aircraft. It would take months to restore the Western Front to a reasonable level of combat effectiveness, particularly given the wastage caused by the pointless fighting in October and November 1943. Although the Western Front had achieved its objectives, there was a great dissatisfaction in the Kremlin about the uneven performance demonstrated during the operation." End quote. But even though there was, this heavy cost and there could be no victory parade in Smolensk, this operation did set up the Red Army for a series of stunning victories in the months to come, all along the Eastern Front. And we'll get to that in the next series of episodes. But now it's time to say goodbye and to thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, still the only English language podcast focusing on the Eastern Front of the Second World War. And I want to make a special thank you to all who are supporting the podcast through Patreon. Remember, you can become a Patreon supporter easily. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa, and this gives you, at whatever level of support you're comfortable with, early, ad-free access to all the episodes, plus bonus episodes. I've put a few maps and pictures on the general public website for this episode to help you better understand how this operation played out. You can find it at beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. If you like this episode, please consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app. And I'd really appreciate a rating on Google or Apple or Spotify, whichever podcasting platform you use. Doing that really helps spread the word that we're here and you might get something out of it. If you find I've made any errors, or if you have a question, a comment, an observation, have anything to say, a reaction to anything we've put in here, please let us know. you can reach me by email at contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Or you could look me up on all the other social medias, Scott Burry, writer, or Scott Burry, author. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina.